time for our Friday interview. This morning it's with the foreign correspondent, Raghi Omar. My goodness, he's got a story to tell. Formerly with the BBC, where he famously covered the Iraq War, he's now ITV News International Affairs Editor. And when I spoke to him, I asked him whether it can be annoying, given his profile, when the public approach him and they think they know him.
Yeah, it is sometimes, but there are very, you know, it changes. I remember just before the terrorist attacks in Sousse in Tunisia, when all those holidaymakers and British holidaymakers were killed on the beach by a gunman, you know, allied with so-called Islamic State. And, you know, it was the day after I was going to my local post office and posting a letter. And, you know, one of the postmen who I'd seen around the neighbourhood where I live just sort of said, look, what should I do? You know, can you advise me? Because I was going to go take my fiancée on holiday to Tunisia. You know, what should I do? And those kind of conversations arrest you, you know. I mean, they really stop you. Because, you know, when you're reporting, you make these reports, it's watched by, you know, millions of, you know, people, it kind of feels you're throwing it out there onto the airwaves, and you wonder as a journalist, when you walk away from so many stories, how does this impact on people's lives, you know, when you're reporting from, you know, drought in the Horn of Africa, or, you know, war in Afghanistan, wherever it is. And those kind of moments actually make you think, God, you know, what we're reporting, actually people make really fundamental decisions on what should I do, how safe do I feel, you know, what's the future for my kids, where should we go? So, yeah, you do get along that, Stephen. I mean, odd times when there was a time when my kids were very young and I was in our local supermarket and, you know, I'd been sent out to sort of buy, you know, didn't have enough nappies, and I get a call from, you know, a rebel commander sort of saying, you know, we're under attack, you know, we need you here, you know, why aren't you reporting? And I'm in aisle 14 trying to look for nappy to take home. There are some surreal moments like that.
Yeah, and the business you're in, international affairs, essentially what you're often doing is you're reminding people who are in the comfort and the coziness of the United Kingdom, of what is happening in places on this planet,
where
life is absolutely different.
Absolutely. No, that's very true. But the other thing is, you know, Stephen, we look around, you know, 30 years ago, where everyone was living, you know, London, you know, Dublin, Belfast, Paris, you know, wherever, life was, you know, pretty much sort of quite homogenous. You look around any of those neighbourhoods where you live, where I live, it's much, you know, we've got neighbours and friends and colleagues who are from these countries. You know, you must get into a taxi and, you know, bump into someone who's originally from Iran or Afghanistan or Pakistan or Somalia, you know. That world is coming to us more and more.
But I guess I'm going slightly further than that, and that I'm saying that, you know, not very many people experience abject hunger in this country like they do on other places where you have been standing beside them.
Yes, that's true. And it is probably one of the hardest things of trying to convey what it's like. And that's the question I get from people when I do meet them more and more. You know, the one thing, if I look back over 25, 26 years, is that question, you were there, what was it like? And that's the hardest thing to try and convey to people when you're, as I was just recently, only a few weeks ago, you know, in a malnutrition ward in Somaliland, in the Horn of Africa, you know, seeing children that had travelled, you know, 100, 200 miles with their mothers who stood on the, you know, the brink of life and death. It's very hard to convey that, because you react to it as a human being. And, you know, there are times that these kind of situations hit you very hard in a visceral level. But then you've got to give, I wouldn't say a dispassionate report, but a truthful and accurate report that gives context as well as feeling.
When you're in those situations, and let's take what you just mentioned, would you put your hand in your pocket or try to feed that child? Or would that be crossing the line?
That's a very, very difficult question. You know, there are times when you do that and it's absolutely the wrong thing. I mean, you know, there are times that I have been in large refugee camps, you know, hundreds, you know, thousands of people. You create more of a problem by what you perceive is your act of kindness.
Why?
It depends. because you can't give everything to everyone. I mean, if you
but you
put
can't
your
give
hand...
something to one person, and it makes a difference to at least one.
That's true.
So what's more important, the journalistic ethics of distance or helping one person?
Hang on, there's times when I've seen riots started, you know, when by small acts of charity to individuals. There are times when you walk away from having given a medical pack that you feel you don't need, you know, in a war zone, where that person who has the medical pack is then preyed upon. I've known journalists who, even in the Rwandan genocide, you know, tried to help individuals, and then when those journalists left, those persons were set upon. And I spoke to the journalist later, said, do you know if that person survived by helping you, the white Western journalist, to leave? So it's a, I've done that. I've done those kind of things occasionally, but there are other times when I've wanted to where I haven't.
And how difficult is it then to walk away? Or do you become... And by the way, look, I make no judgment on you.
Sure.
I'm the same,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. So people, no, I understand that.
You know, people come into this radio studio I'm presenting from on a daily basis. I'm talking to you from Northern Ireland today.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm getting their story, and sometimes their story is about a devastating part of their human life, and I get, you know, a compelling radio show out of it, and they walk away.
Mm. And you go home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I guess I'm just wondering, is that part of the business we're all in?
I think it is. I mean, I found that the...
Does that get to you?
It does. It does. And there are times I look back, you know, as we all do, at the beginning of one's career, where... you felt it much more, and it's a sad and it's a sad reflection on the human condition that you become used to things that you never ever thought you would become used to. I remember the first time I saw a dead body. I was just barely a couple of years into my career. It was the going back all the way to the early to mid 90s. And that haunted me for many, many years. But, you know, you talk to me now, and what do you do when you do see those kind of, you know, a lifeless body who was, you know, somebody's, you know, son or daughter or husband or father or brother? I'd be lying to you if I said that it hit me in the same way. I focus on my job a lot quicker than I would have done, you know, if I look back to the young Raggy Omar. I still have, you know, I still have nightmares and I still have those kind of sort of issues, but less and less.
Mental health and people speaking openly about it, it's just so different now, and it's a contemporary story given what the royals have done just a couple of weeks ago. Do you believe that you suffer from an element of PTSD because of what you've gone through?
I think I did immediately after the Iraq war in 2003. I think there was a summer where I did have, you know, flashbacks, and I think I was becoming a sort of a different, you know, person. I was reacting to things differently.
I'm really interested in this because I'm about to make a documentary for the BBC on PTSD. I'm really interested in this.
Yeah.
So what was happening to you when you came back from Iraq?
Well, I was just a lot shorter, short-tempered with people. I snapped. I had, you know, much more sort of, you know, vivid dreams. And it wasn't just, you know, I just wake up. I was sort of, you know, leaping out of bed, you know, shouting, you know, and that was the moment I'd sort of wake up. But it was just being very, very short tempered, snappy, irritable, you know, not a nice person to be around. And also, I remember... a very good friend who was a sort of very experienced BBC correspondent said to me as I was starting out, said, Raggy, you know, there's a lot of times when you're a young correspondent on the make and you'll get a phone call to say, go to this war zone, go to this sort of, you know, disaster, and you'll be eager to do it. You know, you want to do, that's what you've got into this, you know, business for. And it's a very small business. There aren't a lot of people in it, actually. But one day will come when the phone will ring and you'll think, oh my gosh, I want to hide under the table. I can't bear getting on a plane. And that very much happened. I mean, I really had these, I just froze. You know, I just didn't want to set foot, you know, on a story, on a plane. I didn't want to go.
So the BBC would ring.
Yeah,
and they would say, OK, and this is how it happens, right? This is how it works. They say, right, you know, we need you there now. And you've got the kit in the car and you've got your passport with you and away you go. Were you experiencing a sense of fear?
Yeah, I mean, you look, there's a sense in which you feel that you've used your nine lives up. And, you know, we've all been in extremely, extremely lucky situations when you think back that could have gone very, very badly wrong. And we all know a lot of, you know, close friends and colleagues who haven't come back from stories.
So now you're in that period, a conundrum, because you've got yourself to a place where the BBC wants you. That's your career. It's difficult to say no when you're a foreign cor to go and do a foreign gig. What did you do?
I did say no. And, you know, you just have to find out in yourself. And I think this
How
is
did
the
you
moment.
Say it?
I just said, I'm not going. It just came out from within me. And I just thought, it's that old conundrum. And I know it's an easy sort of thing to say, but it really is true. You know, no story is worth your life. But beyond that, no story is worth your happiness and mental well-being and health. And
where were they sending you, Reggie?
Well, I mean, quite a few places. I've said no quite a few times. I mean, now at ITV News, you know, I haven't been to Syria, and I didn't want to go, and they were very, very supportive about it.
Why didn't you want to go?
I just felt that there's certain rules and certain things that I have as a sort of, you know, I'm very reluctant to go to a story that I don't understand. That I have not, you know, experienced and been to, whose dynamics and journalists on the ground, I don't mean sort of Western journalists, I mean, you know, Syrian or Iraqi or Palestinian or Israeli journalists, unless I know them and have worked with them, because they hold your life in your hands. I mean, you know, the people you'll see, you know, on ITV or BBC or CNN are, you know, the correspondents who bring you the news. The people who make sure that we can function, stay, you know, alive and stay healthy are, you know, the so-called local journalists who you won't see. If I don't know them, if I don't have a connection, if they don't, you know, I won't go, because it's just very, very, very risky.
And that's a fear of dying.
Yes, well, I mean, at its sharpest point, yes, it is, Stephen, but, yes, I suppose it is, but it's also just other things. I mean, just, someone said to me, you know, this is a mantra I live by, you know, you look down the road and you've got the bag and the pack, you know, everyone's packed in the car. If the road that you're staring down, that you've got to go to where the story is, if the road does not feel right, don't go down it.
But a critic would say that for those correspondents, foreign corps, that's the gig. That's the job. So why are you in it if you're not prepared to go anymore?
Well, it's not about not going anymore. I mean, there's, you know, for each Syria that I haven't been to, you know, I've been to Gaza during the, you know, Israeli bombing in 2014. You know, I've just come back from the sort of Horn of Africa. You know, I'm off to Iran in a few days' time. So You can't go to every story, and you have to sort of cover stories that you feel you can and you can cover well.
Okay. Let me come back to the PTSD. How did you get help, and how did it help?
Well, the interesting thing is that I had some reference points before I started, and I went on, you know, courses, as I still do, you know, go on refresher courses that cover not just, you know, how to operate in a hostile environment and how to do, you know, wear a flak jacket and how to patch someone up, but about, you know, mental health in those kind of situations and PTSD. So before I ever really set foot in a war zone, I had training about what PTSD is, you know, and I had a reference point about, you know, other people who suffer, even before I'd even encountered this, you know, situation. So that was an enormous help. And I'd say that's the other thing that's changed enormously about journalism, is that is absolutely built into the fabric of every, you know, news organization these days. And that's very, very important. Before, it was just a case of, you know, there was a great, you know, macho atmosphere around being a war correspondent. It was a case of, you know, if you had these issues, you just went down the pub with the colleagues, and you just, you know, had a few beers and that was it.
You mentioned that how PTSD manifested itself with you was that you were snappier and short-tempered. Did that affect your relationships at home?
I think it sort of did, because that's where I sort of noticed it. It was almost immediately, you know, that it did, that I started to sort of talk about it.
Were you shouting at your wife?
No. I was just snappy with the sort of kids. That's where it sort of, and they were very young, you know, and I just thought it just didn't sort of, you know, feel right. I was just, you know, just a little bit more, come on, let's go, hurry up. And I'm very, very unlike that. And that's where I started to think, actually, maybe this isn't just being a snappy sort of, you know, father that just, you know, is impatient. I mean, I wasn't like that all the time. You know, there was just something about it that I just thought, you know what, maybe it just is coming back from Iraq. And I think because I acted very, very early, it helped me very, very quickly.
And how do they help you?
Well, to recognise it, to recognise what you have been through, because you know, PTSD. You know, there's all kinds of analogies that you could make, but it's something like if you imagine a sort of, you know, your house, your mind is a delicate framed sort of, you know, hut, a house. And this experience comes through like a meteorite, it smashes through the roof and it buries itself deep, you know, under the floorboards. And what you do is you just put lots of sort of other timbers. You try to bury that that meteorite, you know, and pretend everything's all right. And meanwhile, this is smouldering away. And then finally, if you don't act on it, the house catches fire. For me, that's an analogy that really helped.
When's the last time you cried over a story?
Within a few weeks ago. I mean, when we were covering the drought in Somaliland. I mean, definitely. I mean,
what did you cry over? What did you say?
It was a nomad who had heard of, I think it was about 180 odd sort of sheep, and he'd been left with virtually nothing. It was in this sort of, you know, middle of nowhere, this sort of, you know, semi-arid sort of desert. And he was talking about, you know, the last remains that he had. And it wasn't the sort of, you know, it wasn't a cliche, you know, oh my gosh, you know, what's going to happen to him? It was just his resilience that actually moved me. Because I was just interviewing him and he said, look, this is, you know, we're left with nothing. You know, I'm walking that direction to that water. It was the resilience. And also the other thing is you walk away from lots of stories and wonder what happened to people that you leave.
At the very beginning of this interview, I noted that you mentioned your children twice within a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Because of your job, do you not see them as much as you want to? And I'm asking this because you did mention them twice very early on.
Sure, no, it's very, very important. I mean, when you're asking me all those questions about, you know, the job that you do, the cost of workers, I mean, ultimately, you know, as a very good friend of mine said, Raggy, daddy must come home. Yeah. And I have done that, you know, a lot. And, you know, there are...
So here's my question.
But let me preface this, Stephen.
Do you feel guilty not spending enough time with them?
Yes, I have. But what I've done is, I mean, there are lots of missed birthdays and, you know, quite
How
a few sort
they?
Of Christmases. They're teenagers. My daughter's doing GCSEs now, you know, so forth. But I phone them, you know, twice a day, every day, wherever I am, whether it's been in Baghdad, during shock and awe, every single sort of, you know, day. It's interesting because they're at an age now where they comprehend and are interested in the world. And that's a very different scenario because I can share these stories and how they feel about it. And, you know, they're on the verge of being young adults. Much more difficult when they were much younger because they just didn't understand, you know, when I was away. And, of course, periods of time being away seems longer then than it does now.
I noted because I adore the BBC. Mm. It is the most, it's like a relative, right? It frustrates me every day, but I love it, okay? I noted that you criticised the BBC in the past for being a white man's club. Do you still think that's the case?
That was a quote that was sort of taken out of context. I said, you know, for some people, it may look like sometimes that the BBC is a white man's club, and by that one means it is an exclusively middle club class institution. I mean, that's you look around your newsroom, Stephen, and tell me, is it as diverse as the country that you live in? You know, journalism isn't like, you know, it's not. It isn't as yet. It's working hard towards it. That's absolutely the case. So, and it isn't just the BBC. You could say that about where I work now, you know, at ITV, and they're working extremely hard, and you know, and I'm sort of part of it, of sort of diversity. But journalism is not is, I mean, talk about broadcast journalism, is still a difficult gig to break into if you're not... I mean, you know, look, I'm a
is
very...
It's not a difficult gig to break into no matter what the colour of your skin or your background is.
Well, I think I disagree with that. I think, you know, it's in order to get into broadcast media, it's, you know... It used to be that a traineeship, you know, you'd work through local newspapers, you'd just learn the tools of, you know, of the craft. You know, today it's a lot more different with, you know, media studies courses, journalism courses, and the need to, you know, you can't just walk into a decent paid job as a graduate into, you know, newspaper. It's very, very hard. You often need so-called internships or to be able to freelance and volunteer. You know, you need the bank of mum and dad to help you in that, you know, in a lot of cases. Or you need a second job. You know, getting into journalism now is much more in the same way that how difficult it used to be trying to get into acting. You need, you know, there's a lot of years of, you know, no pay in order to break into something.
Do you believe in the license fee?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I think that journalism, which is impartial and free from commercial interests, is vital in a democracy, and I think the BBC delivers the best sort of public service broadcasting.
Isn't your journalism at ITV, which an ITV obviously funded commercially, isn't it just as impartial and authoritative?
It is, but the thing is, there's a lot of things that the commercial broadcasters can't do that the BBC does. I mean, you look at the BBC website. I mean, I think that the entire BBC, you know, internet presence is larger than the combined budgets of ITV, Channel 4, and Channel 5 and Sky put together. You know, it has a global reach in Arabic, in Swahili, in Somali, in Farsi. You know, you can't do that. You know, you can't just see the BBC in terms of what's on BBC One. You have to look at it, you know, internationally.
So why are you choosing not to work for it?
Because I just wanted to step out of the BBC and work somewhere else. Because I felt that...
you're slowing down, so you're thinking carefully now.
I'm thinking carefully. OK, I'll give you an honest answer. I left the BBC because I felt it took a massive body blow to its self-confidence in the wake of Hutton, and it was not itself.
No, that's an answer I'm really interested in.
I bet you are.
So you left the BBC because...
That's what my view, and also because...
You didn't trust it anymore?
No, I wouldn't say that.
What would you say?
I just felt that this was it was an incredibly depressed organisation, which it was. It lost
what
a chairman
mean,
and a chief exec. It didn't know where it was going in the wake of Hutton. It lost its chairman and it lost its director general.
But all of the BBC is much more than... As you know, the journalists and the editors and the fabric of this place,
every organisation, you know, has an ethos, and the Iraq War divided Britain in a way that was, very difficult. And I just felt, look, there are two things that happened in my life at that time. You know, it was living with a post-Hutton BBC, and the emergence of something that was very different in Al Jazeera English, which had just started almost a year
but
and a half later.
What did a post-Hutton BBC feel like that was different?
Well, it just took a massive knock to its self-confidence. It just did. It felt like a place which was, you know, had got a call very, very wrong. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, you don't need, you know, little Raggy Omar to tell you that. It did. It was a seismic moment in the BBC's journalism. We can't deny that. It was on, you know, it was in every newspaper. It was on every talk show. It was a seismic moment.
And you wanted to distance yourself from that organisation?
No.
Well, but you walked away.
Well, I walked away because I wanted to go somewhere where there was a real sort of a sense in which... you know, there wasn't a sense in which a journalism was, it had taken a sort of a punch to the stomach.
And did you not feel any loyalty towards the BBC to stay in there and, you know, at that time when if indeed it was
the
case?
Well, I mean, I'd shown a loyalty to the BBC by staying in Baghdad. I mean, I didn't need to prove my loyalty beyond that.